Disc 5.
Fred was not so happy, however, after he had counted them, for they actually presented the absurdity of being less than his hopefulness had decided that they must be. What can the fitness of things mean, if not their fitness to a man's expectations? Failing this, absurdity and atheism gape behind him. The collapse for Fred was severe when he found that he held no more than 5 20s, and his share in the higher education of this country did not seem to help him. Nevertheless, he said, with rapid changes in his fair complexion, "It is very handsome of you, sir."
"I should think it is," said Mr. Featherstone, locking his box and replacing it, then taking off his spectacles deliberately and at length, as if his inward meditation had more deeply convinced him, repeating, "I should think it is handsome."
"I assure you, sir, I am very grateful," said Fred, who had had time to recover his cheerful air.
"So you ought to be. You want to cut a figure in the world, and I reckon Peter Featherstone is the only one you've got to trust to."
Here the old man's eyes gleamed with a curiously mingled satisfaction in the consciousness that this smart young fellow relied upon him, and that the smart young fellow was rather a fool for doing so. "Yes, indeed. I was not born to very splendid chances. Few men have been more cramped than I have been," said Fred, with some sense of surprise at his own virtue, considering how hardly he was dealt with. "It really seems a little too bad to have to ride a broken-winded hunter and see men who are not half such good judges as yourself able to throw away any amount of money on buying bad bargains."
"Well, you can buy yourself a fine hunter now. £80 is enough for that, I reckon, and you'll have £20 over to get yourself out of any little scrape," said Mr. Featherstone, chuckling slightly.
"You are very good, sir," said Fred, with a fine sense of contrast between the words and his feeling.
"Aye, rather a better uncle than your fine uncle Bulstrode. You won't get much out of his speculations, I think. He's got a pretty strong string round your father's leg, by what I hear, eh?"
"My father never tells me anything about his affairs, sir."
"Well, he shows some sense there. But other people find 'em out without his telling. He'll never have much to leave you. He'll most like die without a will. He's the sort of man to do it. Let 'em make him mayor of Middlemarch as much as they like. But you won't get much by his dying without a will, though you are the eldest son."
Fred thought that Mr. Featherstone had never been so disagreeable before. True, he had never before given him quite so much money at once. "Shall I destroy this letter of Mr. Bulstrode, sir?" said Fred, rising with the letter as if he would put it in the fire.
Aye, I don't want it. It's worth no money to me."
Fred carried the letter to the fire and thrust the poker through it with much zest. He longed to get out of the room, but he was a little ashamed before his inner self, as well as before his uncle, to run away immediately after pocketing the money. Presently the farm bailiff came up to give his master a report, and Fred, to his unspeakable relief, was dismissed, with the injunction to come again soon. He had longed not only to be set free from his uncle, but also to find Mary Garth. She was now in her usual place by the fire, with sewing in her hands and a book open on the little table by her side. Her eyelids had lost some of their redness now, and she had her usual air of self-command. "Am I wanted upstairs?" she said, half rising as Fred entered. "No, I am only dismissed because Simmons is gone up." Mary sat down again and resumed her work. She was certainly treating him with more indifference than usual. She did not know how affectionately indignant he had felt on her behalf upstairs. "May I stay here a little, Mary, or shall I bore you?" "Pray sit down," said Mary. "You will not be so heavy a bore as Mr. John Wall, who was here yesterday, and he sat down without asking my leave. Poor fellow, I think he is in love with you." "I am not aware of it. and to me it is one of the most odious things in a girl's life that there must always be some supposition of falling in love coming between her and any man who is kind to her and to whom she is grateful. I should have thought that I, at least, might have been safe from all that. I have no ground for the nonsensical vanity of fancying everybody who comes near me is in love with me." Mary did not mean to betray a feeling, but in spite of herself she ended in a tremulous tone of vexation. "Confound John Wall! I did not mean to make you angry. I didn't know you had any reason for being grateful to him. I forgot what a great service you think it if anyone snuffs a candle for you." Fred also had his pride, and was not going to show that he knew what had called forth this outburst of Mary's. "Oh, I am not angry, except with the ways of the world. I do like to be spoken to as if I had common sense. I really often feel as if I could understand a little more than I ever hear, even from young gentlemen who have been to college." Mary had recovered, and she spoke with a suppressed, rippling undercurrent of laughter, pleasant to hear. "I don't care how merry you are at my expense this morning," said Fred. "I thought you looked so sad when you came upstairs. It's a shame you should stay here to be bullied in that way." "Oh, I have an easy life by comparison. I have tried being a teacher, but I'm not fit for that. My mind is too fond of wandering on its own way. I think any hardship is better than pretending to do what one is paid for and never really doing it. Everything here I can do as well as anyone else could. Perhaps better than some. Rosie, for example. Though she is just the sort of beautiful creature that is imprisoned with ogres in fairy tales." "Rosie!" cried Fred in a tone of profound brotherly scepticism. "Come, Fred," said Mary emphatically. "You have no right to be so critical." "Do you mean anything particular? Just now?"
"No, I mean something general, always."
"Oh, that I am idle and extravagant.
Well, I am not fit to be a poor man. I should not have made a bad fellow if I had been rich."
"You would have done your duty in that state of life to which it has not pleased God to call you," said Mary, laughing.
"Well, I couldn't do my duty as a clergyman, any more than you could do yours as a governess. You ought to have a little fellow feeling there, Mary."
"I never said you ought to be a clergyman. There are other sorts of work. It seems to me very miserable not to resolve on some course and act accordingly."
"So I could if—"
Fred broke off and stood up, leaning against the mantelpiece.
"If you were sure you should not have a fortune."
"I did not say that. You want to quarrel with me. It's too bad of you to be guided by what other people say about me."
"How can I want to quarrel with you?
I should be quarrelling with all my new books," said Mary, lifting the volume on the table.
"However naughty you may be to other people, you are good to me."
"Because I like you better than anyone else. But I know you despise me."
"Yes, I do, a little," said Mary, nodding with a smile.
"You would admire a stupendous fellow who would have wise opinions about everything."
"Yes, I should."
Mary was sewing swiftly, and seemed provokingly mistress of the situation. When a conversation has taken a wrong turn for us, we only get farther and farther into the swamp of awkwardness. This was what Fred Vincey felt. "I suppose a woman is never in love with anyone she has always known, ever since she can remember, as a man often is. It is always some new fellow who strikes a girl."
"Let me see," said Mary, the corners of her mouth curling archly. "I must go back on my experience. There is Juliet. She seems an example of what you say. But then, Ophelia had probably known Hamlet a long while. And Brenda Troil, she had known Maud and Merton ever since they were children. But then, he seems to have been an estimable young man. And Minna was still more deeply in love with Cleveland, who was a stranger. Waverley was new to Flora MacIver, but then she did not fall in love with him. And there are Olivia and Sophia Primrose and Corinne. They may be said to have fallen in love with new men. Altogether, my experience is rather mixed."
Mary looked up with some roguishness at Fred, and that look of hers was very dear to him, though the eyes were nothing more than clear windows where observation sat laughingly. He was certainly an affectionate fellow. And as he had grown from boy to man, he had grown in love with his old playmate. Notwithstanding that share in the higher education of the country, which had exalted his views of rank and income. When a man is not loved, it's no use for him to say that he could be a better fellow, could do anything. I mean, if he was sure of being loved in return. Not of the least use in the world for him to say he could be better. Might, could, would, they are contemptible auxiliaries. I don't see how a man is to be good for much unless he has some one woman to love him dearly. I think the goodness should come before he expects that. You know better, Mary. Women don't love their men for their goodness. Perhaps not. But if they love them, they never think them bad. It is hardly fair to say I am bad. I said nothing at all about you. I shall never be good for anything, Mary, if you will not say that you love me, if you will not promise to marry me. I mean, when I am able to marry. If I did love you, I would not marry you. I would certainly not promise ever to marry you. I think that is quite wicked, Mary. If you love me, you ought to promise to marry me. On the contrary, I think it would be wicked in me to marry you, even if I did love you. You mean, just as I am, without any means of maintaining a wife. Of course, I am but 23. In that last point, you will alter. But I am not so sure of any other alteration. My father says an idle man ought not to exist, much less be married. Then I am to blow my brains out? No. On the whole, I should think you would do better to pass your examination. I have heard Mr. Fairbrother say it is disgracefully easy. That is all very fine. Anything is easy to him. Not that cleverness has anything to do with it. I am 10 times cleverer than many men who pass. Dear me, said Mary, unable to repress her sarcasm. That accounts for the curates like Mr. Crowes. Divide your cleverness by 10, and the quotient, dear me, is able to take a degree. But that only shows you are 10 times more idle than the others. Well, if I did pass, you would not want me to go into the church. That is not the question, what I want you to do. You have a conscience of your own, I suppose. There is Mr. Lydgate. I must go and tell my uncle. Mary, said Fred, seizing her hand as she rose, if you will not give me some encouragement, I shall get worse instead of better. I will not give you any encouragement, said Mary, reddening. Your friends would dislike it, and so would mine. My father would think it a disgrace to me if I accepted a man who got into debt and would not work. Fred was stung and released her hand. She walked to the door, but there she turned and said, Fred, you have always been so good, so generous to me. I am not ungrateful. But never speak to me in that way again. Very well, said Fred sulkily, taking up his hat and whip. His complexion showed patches of pale pink and dead white. Like many a plucked, idle young gentleman, he was thoroughly in love, and with a plain girl who had no money. But having Mr. Featherstone's land in the background, and a persuasion that, let Mary say what she would, she really did care for him, Fred was not utterly in despair. When he got home, he gave 4 of the 20s to his mother, asking her to keep them for him. I don't want to spend that money, Mother. I want it to pay a debt with. So keep it safe away from my fingers. Bless you, my dear, said Mrs. Vincey. She doted on her eldest son and her youngest girl, a child of 6, whom others thought her 2 naughtiest children. The mother's eyes are not always deceived in their partiality. She at least can best judge who is the tender, filial-hearted child. And Fred was certainly very fond of his mother. Perhaps it was his fondness for another person also, that made him particularly anxious to take some security against his own liability to spend the £100. For the creditor to whom he owed 160 held a firmer security in the shape of a bill signed by Mary's father. Chapter 15. A great historian, as he insisted on calling himself, who had the happiness to be dead 120 years ago, and so to take his place among the colossi whose huge legs our living pettiness is observed to walk under, glories in his copious remarks and digressions as the least imitable part of his work, and especially in those initial chapters to the successive books of his history, where he seems to bring his armchair to the proscenium and chat with us in all the lusty ease of his fine English. But Fielding lived when the days were longer, for time, like money, is measured by our needs, when summer afternoons were spacious and the clock ticked slowly in the winter evenings. We belated historians must not linger after his example, and if we did so, it is probable that our chat would be thin and eager, as if delivered from a camp stool in a parrot house. I, at least, have so much to do in unravelling certain human lots and seeing how they were woven and interwoven, that all the light I can command must be concentrated on this particular web, and not dispersed over that tempting range of relevancies called the universe. At present, I have to make the new settler Lydgate better known to anyone interested in him than he could possibly be, even to those who had seen the most of him since his arrival in Middlemarch. For surely all must admit that a man may be puffed and belauded, envied, ridiculed, counted upon as a tool and fallen in love with, or at least selected as a future husband, and yet remain virtually unknown, known merely as a cluster of signs for his neighbour's false suppositions. There was a general impression, however, that Lydgate was not altogether a common country doctor, and in Middlemarch at that time such an impression was significant of great things being expected from him, for everybody's family doctor was remarkably clever, and was understood to have immeasurable skill in the management and training of the most skittish or vicious diseases. The evidence of his cleverness was of the higher intuitive order, lying in his lady patient's immovable conviction, and was unassailable by any objection except that their intuitions were opposed by others equally strong. Each lady who saw medical truth in Wrench and the strengthening treatment, regarding Toller and the lowering system as medical perdition. For the heroic times of copious bleeding and blistering had not yet departed, still less the times of thoroughgoing theory, when disease in general was called by some bad name and treated accordingly without shilly-shally, as if, for example, it were to be called insurrection, which must not be fired on with blank cartridge, but have its blood drawn at once. The strengtheners and the lowerers were all clever men in somebody's opinion, which is really as much as can be said for any living talents. Nobody's imagination had gone so far as to conjecture that Mr. Lydgate could know as much as Dr. Sprague and Dr. Minchin, the two physicians who alone could offer any hope when danger was extreme, and when the smallest hope was worth a guinea. Still, I repeat, there was a general impression that Lydgate was something rather more uncommon than any general practitioner in Middlemarch. And this was true. He was but 27, an age at which many men are not quite common, at which they are hopeful of achievement, resolute in avoidance, thinking that mammon shall never put a bit in their mouths and get astride their backs, but rather that mammon, if they have anything to do with him, shall draw their chariot. He had been left an orphan when he was fresh from a public school. His father, a military man, had made but little provision for three children. And when the boy, Tertius, asked to have a medical education, it seemed easier to his guardians to grant his request by apprenticing him to a country practitioner than to make any objections on the score of family dignity. He was one of the rarer lads who early get a decided bent and make up their minds that there is something particular in life which they would like to do for its own sake, and not because their fathers did it. Most of us who turn to any subject we love remember some morning or evening hour when we got on a high stool to reach down an untried volume, or sat with parted lips listening to a new talker, or for very lack of books began to listen to the voices within as the first traceable beginning of our love. Something of that sort happened to Lydgate. He was a quick fellow, and when hot from play, would toss himself in a corner and in 5 minutes be deep in any sort of book that he could lay his hands on. If it were Rasselas or Gulliver, so much the better. But Bailey's Dictionary would do, or the Bible with the Apocrypha in it. Something he must read when he was not riding the pony, or running and hunting, or listening to the talk of men. All this was true of him at 10 years of age. He had then read through Kreisel or The Adventures of a Guinea, which was neither milk for babes, nor any chalky mixture meant to pass for milk. And it had already occurred to him that books were stuff, and that life was stupid. His school studies had not much modified that opinion, for though he did his classics and mathematics, he was not preeminent in them. It was said of him that Lydgate could do anything he liked, but he had certainly not yet liked to do anything remarkable. He was a vigorous animal with a ready understanding, but no spark had yet kindled in him an intellectual passion. Knowledge seemed to him a very superficial affair, easily mastered. Judging from the conversation of his elders, he had apparently got already more than was necessary for mature life. Probably this was not an exceptional result of expensive teaching, at that period of short-waisted coats and other fashions which have not yet recurred. But one vacation, a wet day, sent him to the small home library to hunt once more for a book which might have some freshness for him. In vain. Unless, indeed, he took down a dusty row of volumes with grey paper backs and dingy labels, the volumes of an old cyclopaedia which he had never disturbed. It would at least be a novelty to disturb them. They were on the highest shelf, and he stood on a chair to get them down. But he opened the volume which he first took from the shelf. Somehow one is apt to read in a makeshift attitude, just where it might seem inconvenient to do so. The page he opened on was under the heading of anatomy, and the first passage that drew his eyes was on the valves of the heart. He was not much acquainted with valves of any sort, but he knew that valvae were folding doors, and through this crevice came a sudden light, startling him with his first vivid notion of finely adjusted mechanism in the human frame. A liberal education had, of course, left him free to read the indecent passages in the school classics, but beyond a general sense of secrecy and obscenity in connection with his internal structure, had left his imagination quite unbiased, so that for anything he knew, his brains lay in small bags at his temples, and he had no more thought of representing to himself how his blood circulated than how paper served instead of gold. But the moment of vocation had come, and before he got down from his chair, the world was made new to him by a presentiment of endless processes filling the vast spaces planked out of his sight by that wordy ignorance which he had supposed to be knowledge. From that hour, Lydgate felt the growth of an intellectual passion. We are not afraid of telling over and over again how a man comes to fall in love with a woman and be wedded to her, or else be fatally parted from her. Is it due to excess of poetry or of stupidity that we are never weary of describing what King James called a woman's "macdom and her fairness," never weary of listening to the twanging of the old troubadour strings, and are comparatively uninterested in that other kind of "macdom and fairness," which must be wooed with industrious thought and patient renunciation of small desires? In the story of this passion, too, the development varies. Sometimes it is the glorious marriage, sometimes frustration and final parting. And not seldom, the catastrophe is bound up with the other passion sung by the troubadours. For in the multitude of middle-aged men who go about their vocations in a daily course determined for them much in the same way as the tie of their cravats, there is always a good number who once meant to shape their own deeds and alter the world a little. The story of their coming to be shapen after the average and fit to be packed by the gross is hardly ever told, even in their consciousness. For perhaps their ardour in generous unpaid toil cooled as imperceptibly as the ardour of other youthful loves, till one day their earlier self walked like a ghost in its old home and made the new furniture ghastly. Nothing in the world more subtle than the process of their gradual change. In the beginning, they inhaled it unknowingly. You and I may have sent some of our breath towards infecting them when we uttered our conforming falsities or drew our silly conclusions. Or perhaps it came with the vibrations from a woman's glance. Lydgate did not mean to be one of those failures, and there was the better hope of him, because his scientific interest soon took the form of a professional enthusiasm. He had a youthful belief in his bread-winning work, not to be stifled by that initiation in makeshift called his prentice days. And he carried to his studies in London, Edinburgh, and Paris the conviction that the medical profession, as it might be, was the finest in the world, presenting the most perfect interchange between science and art, offering the most direct alliance between intellectual conquest and the social good. Lydgate's nature demanded this combination. He was an emotional creature, with a flesh-and-blood sense of fellowship which withstood all the abstractions of special study. He cared not only for cases, but for John and Elizabeth. Especially Elizabeth. There was another attraction in this profession. It wanted reform, and gave a man an opportunity for some indignant resolve to reject its venal decorations and other humbug, and to be the possessor of genuine, though undemanded, qualifications. He went to study in Paris with the determination that when he came home again he would settle in some provincial town as a general practitioner, and resist the irrational severance between medical and surgical knowledge in the interest of his own scientific pursuits, as well as of the general advance. He would keep away from the range of London intrigues, jealousies, and social truckling, and win celebrity, however slowly, as Jenner had done, by the independent value of his work. For it must be remembered that this was a dark period, and in spite of venerable colleges which used great efforts to secure purity of knowledge by making it scarce, and to exclude error by a rigid exclusiveness in relation to fees and appointments, it happened that very ignorant young gentlemen were promoted in town, and many more got a legal right to practice over large areas in the country. Also, the high standard held up to the public mind by the College of Physicians, which gave its peculiar sanction to the expensive and highly rarefied medical instruction obtained by graduates of Oxford and Cambridge, did not hinder quackery from having an excellent time of it. For since professional practice chiefly consisted in giving a great many drugs, the public inferred that it might be better off with more drugs still, if they could only be got cheaply, and hence swallowed large cubic measures of physic, prescribed by unscrupulous ignorance which had taken no degrees. Considering that statistics had not yet embraced a calculation as to the number of ignorant or canting doctors which absolutely must exist in the teeth of all changes, it seemed to Lydgate that a change in the units was the most direct mode of changing the numbers. He meant to be a unit who would make a certain amount of difference towards that spreading change which would one day tell appreciably upon the averages, and in the meantime have the pleasure of making an advantageous difference to the viscera of his own patients. But he did not simply aim at a more genuine kind of practice than was common. He was ambitious of a wider effect. He was fired with the possibility that he might work out the proof of an anatomical conception and make a link in the chain of discovery. Does it seem incongruous to you that a Middlemarch surgeon should dream of himself as a discoverer? Most of us, indeed, know little of the great originators until they have been lifted up among the constellations and already rule our fates. But that Herschel, for example, who broke the barriers of the heavens, did he not once play a provincial church organ and give music lessons to stumbling pianists? Each of those shining ones had to walk on the earth among neighbours who perhaps thought much more of his gait and his garments than of anything which was to give him a title to everlasting fame. Each of them had his little local personal history, sprinkled with small temptations and sordid cares, which made the retarding friction of his course towards final companionship with the immortals. Lydgate was not blind to the dangers of such friction, but he had plenty of confidence in his resolution to avoid it as far as possible. Being 27, he felt himself experienced, and he was not going to have his vanities provoked by contact with the showy, worldly successes of the capital, but to live among people who could hold no rivalry with that pursuit of a great idea, which was to be a twin object with the assiduous practice of his profession. There was fascination in the hope that the two purposes would illuminate each other. The careful observation and inference which was his daily work, the use of the lens to further his judgment in special cases, would further his thought as an instrument of larger inquiry. Was not this the typical preeminence of his profession? He would be a good Middlemarch doctor, and by that very means keep himself in the track of far-reaching investigation. On one point, he may fairly claim approval at this particular stage of his career. He did not mean to imitate those philanthropic models who make a profit out of poisonous pickles to support themselves while they are exposing adulteration, or hold shares in a gambling hell that they may have leisure to represent the cause of public morality. He intended to begin, in his own case, some particular reforms which were quite certainly within his reach, and much less of a problem than the demonstrating of an anatomical conception. One of these reforms was to act stoutly on the strength of a recent legal decision and simply prescribe without dispensing drugs or taking percentage from druggists. This was an innovation for one who had chosen to adopt the style of general practitioner in a country town, and would be felt as offensive criticism by his professional brethren. But Lydgate meant to innovate in his treatment also, and he was wise enough to see that the best security for his practising honestly according to his belief was to get rid of systematic temptations to the contrary. Perhaps that was a more cheerful time for observers and theorisers than the present. We are apt to think it the finest era of the world when America was beginning to be discovered, when a bold sailor, even if he were wrecked, might alight on a new kingdom. And about 1829, the dark territories of pathology were a fine America for a spirited young adventurer. Lydgate was ambitious, above all, to contribute towards enlarging the scientific, rational basis of his profession. The more he became interested in special questions of disease, such as the nature of fever or fevers, the more keenly he felt the need for that fundamental knowledge of structure, which, just at the beginning of the century, had been illuminated by the brief and glorious career of Bichat, who died when he was only 31, but, like another Alexander, left a realm large enough for many heirs. That great Frenchman first carried out the conception that living bodies, fundamentally considered, are not associations of organs which can be understood by studying them first apart, and then, as it were, federally, but must be regarded as consisting of certain primary webs or tissues, out of which the various organs, brain, heart, lungs, and so on, are compacted, as the various accommodations of a house are built up in various proportions of wood, iron, stone, brick, zinc, and the rest, each material having its peculiar composition and proportions. No man, one sees, can understand and estimate the entire structure or its parts. What are its frailties and what its repairs, without knowing the nature of the materials? And the conception wrought out by Bichat, with his detailed study of the different tissues, acted necessarily on medical questions as the turning of gaslight would act on a dim, oil-lit street, showing new connections and hitherto hidden facts of structure which must be taken into account in considering the symptoms of maladies and the action of medicaments. But results which depend on human conscience and intelligence work slowly. And now, at the end of 1829, most medical practice was still strutting or shambling along the old paths, and there was still scientific work to be done, which might have seemed to be a direct sequence of Bichat's. This great seer did not go beyond the consideration of the tissues as ultimate facts in the living organism, marking the limit of anatomical analysis. But it was open to another mind to say, have not these structures some common basis from which they have all started, as your sarsenet, gauze, net, satin and velvet from the raw cocoon? Here would be another light, as of oxyhydrogen, showing the very grain of things, and revising all former explanations. Of this sequence to Bichat's work, already vibrating along many currents of the European mind, Lydgate was enamoured. He longed to demonstrate the more intimate relations of living structure, and help to define men's thought more accurately after the true order. The work had not yet been done, but only prepared, for those who knew how to use the preparation. What was the primitive tissue? In that way, Lydgate put the question. Not quite in the way required by the awaiting answer, but such missing of the right word befalls many seekers. And he counted on quiet intervals to be watchfully seized, for taking up the threads of investigation, on many hints to be won from diligent application, not only of the scalpel, but of the microscope, which research had begun to use again with new enthusiasm of reliance. Such was Lydgate's plan of his future, to do good small work for Middlemarch, and great work for the world. He was certainly a happy fellow at this time. To be 27, without any fixed vices, with a generous resolution that his action should be beneficent, and with ideas in his brain that made life interesting, quite apart from the cultus of horseflesh and other mystic rites of costly observance, which the £800 left him after buying his practice would certainly not have gone far in paying for. He was at a starting point which makes many a man's career a fine subject for betting, if there were any gentleman given to that amusement who could appreciate the complicated probabilities of an arduous purpose with all the possible thwartings and furtherings of circumstance, all the niceties of inward balance by which a man swims and makes his point, or else is carried headlong. The risk would remain, even with close knowledge of Lydgate's character, for character too is a process and an unfolding. The man was still in the making, as much as the Middlemarch doctor and immortal discoverer, and there were both virtues and faults capable of shrinking or expanding. The faults will not, I hope, be a reason for the withdrawal of your interest in him. Among our valued friends, is there not someone or other who is a little too self-confident and disdainful, whose distinguished mind is a little spotted with commonness, who is a little pinched here and protuberant there with native prejudices, or whose better energies are liable to lapse down the wrong channel under the influence of transient solicitations? All these things might be alleged against Lydgate, but then they are the periphrases of a polite preacher who talks of Adam and would not like to mention anything painful to the pew-renters. The particular faults from which these delicate generalities are distilled have distinguishable physiognomies, diction, accent, and grimaces, filling up parts in very various dramas. Our vanities differ as our noses do. All conceit is not the same conceit, but varies in correspondence with the minutiae of mental make, in which one of us differs from another. Lydgate's conceit was of the arrogant sort, never simpering, never impertinent, but massive in its claims and benevolently contemptuous. He would do a great deal for noodles, being sorry for them and feeling quite sure that they could have no power over him. He had thought of joining the St. Simonians when he was in Paris in order to turn them against some of their own doctrines. All his faults were marked by kindred traits, and were those of a man who had a fine baritone, whose clothes hung well upon him, and who even in his ordinary gestures had an air of inbred distinction. Where, then, lay the spots of commonness? Says a young lady enamoured of that careless grace. How could there be any commonness in a man so well-bred, so ambitious of social distinction, so generous and unusual in his views of social duty? As easily as there may be stupidity in a man of genius, if you take him unawares on the wrong subject, or as many a man who has the best will to advance the social millennium might be ill-inspired in imagining its lighter pleasures, unable to go beyond Offenbach's music or the brilliant punning in the last burlesque. Lydgate's spots of commonness lay in the complexion of his prejudices, which, in spite of noble intentions and sympathy, were half of them such as are found in ordinary men of the world. That distinction of mind which belonged to his intellectual ardour did not penetrate his feeling and judgment about furniture or women, or the desirability of its being known, without his telling, that he was better born than other country surgeons. He did not mean to think of furniture at present, but whenever he did so, it was to be feared that neither biology nor schemes of reform would lift him above the vulgarity of feeling that there would be an incompatibility in his furniture not being of the best. As to women, he had once already been drawn headlong by impetuous folly, which he meant to be final, since marriage, at some distant period, would of course not be impetuous. For those who want to be acquainted with Lydgate, it will be good to know what was that case of impetuous folly, for it may stand as an example of the fitful swerving of passion to which he was prone, together with the chivalrous kindness which helped to make him morally lovable. The story can be told without many words. It happened when he was studying in Paris, and just at the time when, over and above his other work, he was occupied with some galvanic experiments. One evening, tired with his experimenting, and not being able to elicit the facts he needed, he left his frogs and rabbits to some repose under their trying and mysterious dispensation of unexplained shocks, and went to finish his evening at the theatre of the Porte Saint-Martin, where there was a melodrama, which he had already seen several times. Attracted not by the ingenious work of the collaborating authors, but by an actress, whose part it was to stab her lover, mistaking him for the evil-designing duke of the piece. Lydgate was in love with this actress, as a man is in love with a woman whom he never expects to speak to. She was a Provençal, with dark eyes, a Greek profile, and rounded, majestic form, having that sort of beauty which carries a sweet matronliness, even in youth, and her voice was a soft cooing. She had but lately come to Paris, and bore a virtuous reputation, her husband acting with her as the unfortunate lover. It was her acting which was no better than it should be, but the public was satisfied. Lydgate's only relaxation now was to go and look at this woman, just as he might have thrown himself under the breath of the sweet south on a bank of violets for a while, without prejudice to his galvanism to which he would presently return. But this evening, the old drama had a new catastrophe. At the moment when the heroine was to act the stabbing of her lover, and he was to fall gracefully, the wife veritably stabbed her husband, who fell as death willed. A wild shriek pierced the house, and the Provençal fell swooning. A shriek and a swoon were demanded by the play, but the swooning, too, was real this time. Lydgate leaped and climbed, he hardly knew how, onto the stage, and was active in help, making the acquaintance of his heroine by finding a contusion on her head and lifting her gently in his arms. Paris rang with the story of this death. Was it a murder? Some of the actress's warmest admirers were inclined to believe in her guilt, and liked her the better for it. Such was the taste of those times. But Lydgate was not one of these. He vehemently contended for her innocence, and the remote impersonal passion for her beauty, which he had felt before, had passed now into personal devotion and tender thought of her lot. The notion of murder was absurd. No motive was discoverable, the young couple being understood to dote on each other. And it was not unprecedented that an accidental slip of the foot should have brought these grave consequences. The legal investigation ended in Madame Laure's release. Lydgate, by this time, had had many interviews with her, and found her more and more adorable. She talked little, but that was an additional charm. She was melancholy and seemed grateful. Her presence was enough, like that of the evening light. Lydgate was madly anxious about her affection, and jealous lest any other man than himself should win it and ask her to marry him. But instead of reopening her engagement at the Porte Saint-Martin, where she would have been all the more popular for the fatal episode, she left Paris without warning, forsaking her little court of admirers. Perhaps no one carried inquiry far, except Lydgate, who felt that all science had come to a standstill while he imagined the unhappy Laure stricken by ever-wandering sorrow, herself wandering and finding no faithful comforter. Hidden actresses, however, are not so difficult to find as some other hidden facts, and it was not long before Lydgate gathered indications that Laure had taken the route to Lyon. He found her at last, acting with great success at Avignon, under the same name, looking more majestic than ever, as a forsaken wife carrying her child in her arms. He spoke to her after the play, was received with the usual quietude, which seemed to him beautiful as clear depths of water, and obtained leave to visit her the next day, when he was bent on telling her that he adored her, and on asking her to marry him. He knew that this was like the sudden impulse of a madman, incongruous even with his habitual foibles. No matter. It was the one thing which he was resolved to do. He had two selves within him, apparently, and they must learn to accommodate each other and bear reciprocal impediments. Strange that some of us, with quick alternate vision, see beyond our infatuations, and even while we rave on the heights, behold the wide plain where our persistent self pauses and awaits us. To have approached Laure with any suit that was not reverentially tender would have been simply a contradiction of his whole feeling towards her. "You have come all the way from Paris to find me," she said to him the next day, sitting before him with folded arms and looking at him with eyes that seemed to wonder, as an untamed, ruminating animal wonders. "Are all Englishmen like that?" "I came because I could not live without trying to see you. You are lonely. I love you. I want you to consent to be my wife. I will wait, but I want you to promise that you will marry me, no one else." Laure looked at him in silence, with a melancholy radiance from under her grand eyelids, until he was full of rapturous certainty and knelt close to her knees. "I will tell you something," she said in her cooing way, keeping her arms folded. "My foot really slipped."
I know," said Lydgate deprecatingly. "It was a fatal accident, a dreadful stroke of calamity, that bound me to you the more."
Again Laure paused a little, and then said slowly, "I meant to do it." Lydgate, strong man as he was, turned pale and trembled. Moments seemed to pass before he rose and stood at a distance from her. "There was a secret, then," he said at last, even vehemently. "He was brutal to you. You hated him."
"No. He wearied me. He was too fond. He would live in Paris and not in my country. That was not agreeable to me."
"Great God!" said Lydgate in a groan of horror. "And you planned to murder him?"
"I did not plan. It came to me in the play. I meant to do it."
Lydgate stood mute and unconsciously pressed his hat on while he looked at her. He saw this woman, the first to whom he had given his young adoration, amid the throng of stupid criminals.
"You are a good young man," she said, "but I do not like husbands. I will never have another."
3 days afterwards, Lydgate was at his galvanism again in his Paris chambers, believing that illusions were at an end for him. He was saved from hardening effects by the abundant kindness of his heart and his belief that human life might be made better. But he had more reason than ever for trusting his judgment, now that it was so experienced, and henceforth he would take a strictly scientific view of woman, entertaining no expectations but such as were justified beforehand. No one in Middlemarch was likely to have such a notion of Lydgate's past as has here been faintly shadowed. And indeed, the respectable townsfolk there were not more given than mortals generally to any eager attempt at exactness in the representation to themselves of what did not come under their own senses. Not only young virgins of that town, but grey-bearded men also, were often in haste to conjecture how a new acquaintance might be wrought into their purposes, contented with very vague knowledge as to the way in which life had been shaping him for that instrumentality. Middlemarch, in fact, counted on swallowing Lydgate and assimilating him very comfortably.
Chapter 16. The question whether Mr. Tyke should be appointed as salaried chaplain to the hospital was an exciting topic to the Middlemarchers, and Lydgate heard it discussed in a way that threw much light on the power exercised in the town by Mr. Bulstrode. The banker was evidently a ruler, but there was an opposition party, and even among his supporters there were some who allowed it to be seen that their support was a compromise, and who frankly stated their impression that the general scheme of things, and especially the casualties of trade, required you to hold a candle to the devil. Mr. Bulstrode's power was not due simply to his being a country banker who knew the financial secrets of most traders in the town and could touch the springs of their credit. It was fortified by a beneficence that was at once ready and severe, ready to confer obligations and severe in watching the result. He had gathered, as an industrious man always at his post, a chief share in administering the town charities, and his private charities were both minute and abundant. He would take a great deal of pains about apprenticing Tegg, the shoemaker's son, and he would watch over Tegg's church-going. He would defend Mrs. Stripe, the washerwoman, against Stubbs' unjust exaction on the score of her drying-ground, and he would himself scrutinise a calumny against Mrs. Stripe. His private minor loans were numerous, but he would inquire strictly into the circumstances both before and after. In this way, a man gathers a domain in his neighbour's hope and fear, as well as gratitude, and power, when once it has got into that subtle region, propagates itself, spreading out of all proportion to its external means. It was a principle with Mr. Bulstrode to gain as much power as possible, that he might use it for the glory of God. He went through a great deal of spiritual conflict and inward argument in order to adjust his motives and make clear to himself what God's glory required. But, as we have seen, his motives were not always rightly appreciated. There were many crass minds in Middlemarch whose reflective scales could only weigh things in the lump, and they had a strong suspicion that since Mr. Bulstrode could not enjoy life in their fashion, eating and drinking so little as he did and worriting himself about everything, he must have a sort of vampire's feast in the sense of mastery. The subject of the chaplaincy came up at Mr. Vincey's table when Lydgate was dining there, and the family connection with Mr. Bulstrode did not, he observed, prevent some freedom of remark, even on the part of the host himself, though his reasons against the proposed arrangement turned entirely on his objection to Mr. Tyke's sermons, which were all doctrine, and his preference for Mr. Fairbrother, whose sermons were free from that taint. Mr. Vincey liked well enough the notion of the chaplain's having a salary, supposing it were given to Fairbrother, who was as good a little fellow as ever breathed, and the best preacher anywhere, and companionable too. "What line shall you take, then?" said Mr. Chichely, the coroner, a great coursing comrade of Mr. Vincey's. "Oh, I'm precious glad I'm not one of the directors now. I shall vote for referring the matter to the directors and the medical board together. I shall roll some of my responsibility on your shoulders, doctor," said Mr. Vincey, glancing first at Dr. Sprague, the senior physician of the town, and then at Lydgate, who sat opposite. "You medical gentlemen must consult which sort of black draught you will prescribe, eh, Mr. Lydgate?" "I know little of either," said Lydgate. "But in general, appointments are apt to be made too much a question of personal liking. The fittest man for a particular post is not always the best fellow or the most agreeable. Sometimes, if you wanted to get a reform, your only way would be to pension off the good fellows whom everybody is fond of and put them out of the question." Dr. Sprague, who was considered the physician of most weight, though Dr. Minchin was usually said to have more penetration, divested his large, heavy face of all expression and looked at his wine-glass while Lydgate was speaking. Whatever was not problematical and suspected about this young man, for example, a certain showiness as to foreign ideas, and a disposition to unsettle what had been settled and forgotten by his elders, was positively unwelcome to a physician whose standing had been fixed 30 years before by a treatise on meningitis, of which at least one copy, marked Own, was bound in calf. For my part, I have some fellow feeling with Dr. Sprague. One's self-satisfaction is an untaxed kind of property, which it is very unpleasant to find depreciated. Lydgate's remark, however, did not meet the sense of the company. Mr. Vincey said that if he could have his way, he would not put disagreeable fellows anywhere. "Hang your reforms," said Mr. Chichely. "There's no greater humbug in the world. You never hear of a reform, but it means some trick to put in new men. I hope you are not one of the Lancet's men, Mr. Lydgate, wanting to take the coronership out of the hands of the legal profession. Your words appear to point that way." "I disapprove of Wakeley," interposed Dr. Sprague. "No man more. He is an ill-intentioned fellow who would sacrifice the respectability of the profession, which everybody knows depends on the London colleges, for the sake of getting some notoriety for himself. There are men who don't mind about being kicked blue if they can only get talked about. But Wakeley is right sometimes," the doctor added judicially. "I could mention one or two points in which Wakeley is in the right."
"Oh, well," said Mr. Chichely, "I blame no man for standing up in favour of his own cloth. But coming to argument, I should like to know how a coroner is to judge of evidence if he has not had a legal training."
"In my opinion," said Lydgate, "legal training only makes a man more incompetent in questions that require knowledge of another kind. People talk about evidence as if it could really be weighed in scales by a blind justice. No man can judge what is good evidence on any particular subject unless he knows that subject well. A lawyer is no better than an old woman at a post-mortem examination. How is he to know the action of a poison? You might as well say that scanning verse will teach you to scan the potato crops."
"You are aware, I suppose, that it is not the coroner's business to conduct the post-mortem, but only to take the evidence of the medical witness," said Mr. Chichely, with some scorn.
"Who is often almost as ignorant as the coroner himself," said Lydgate. "Questions of medical jurisprudence ought not to be left to the chance of decent knowledge in a medical witness, and the coroner ought not to be a man who will believe that strychnine will destroy the coats of the stomach if an ignorant practitioner happens to tell him so."
Lydgate had really lost sight of the fact that Mr. Chichely was His Majesty's coroner, and ended innocently with the question, "Don't you agree with me, Dr. Sprague?"
"To a certain extent, with regard to populous districts, and in the metropolis," said the doctor. "But I hope it will be long before this part of the country loses the services of my friend Chichely, even though it might get the best man in our profession to succeed him. I am sure Vincey will agree with me."
"Yes, yes, give me a coroner who is a good coursing man," said Mr. Vincey jovially. "And in my opinion you're safest with a lawyer. Nobody can know everything. Most things are visitation of God. And as to poisoning, why, what you want to know is the law. Come, shall we join the ladies?"
Lydgate's private opinion was that Mr. Chichely might be the very coroner without bias as to the coats of the stomach, but he had not meant to be personal. This was one of the difficulties of moving in good Middlemarch society. It was dangerous to insist on knowledge as a qualification for any salaried office. Fred Vincey had called Lydgate a prig, and now Mr. Chichely was inclined to call him prick-eared, especially when, in the drawing-room, he seemed to be making himself eminently agreeable to Rosamond, whom he had easily monopolised in a tête-à-tête, since Mrs. Vincey herself sat at the tea-table. She resigned no domestic function to her daughter, and the matron's blooming, good-natured face, with the two volatile pink strings floating from her fine throat and her cheery manners to husband and children, was certainly among the great attractions of the Vincey house, attractions which made it all the easier to fall in love with the daughter. The tinge of unpretentious, inoffensive vulgarity in Mrs. Vincey gave more effect to Rosamond's refinement, which was beyond what Lydgate had expected. Certainly, small feet and perfectly turned shoulders aid the impression of refined manners, and the right thing said seems quite astonishingly right when it is accompanied with exquisite curves of lip and eyelid. And Rosamond could say the right thing, for she was clever, with that sort of cleverness which catches every tone except the humorous. Happily, she never attempted to joke, and this perhaps was the most decisive mark of her cleverness. She and Lydgate readily got into conversation. He regretted that he had not heard her sing the other day at Stone Court. The only pleasure he allowed himself during the latter part of his stay in Paris was to go and hear music. "You have studied music, probably," said Rosamond.
"No. I know the notes of many birds, and I know many melodies by ear. But the music that I don't know at all, and have no notion about, delights me, affects me. How stupid the world is that it does not make more use of such a pleasure within its reach."
"Yes, and you will find Middlemarch very tuneless. There are hardly any good musicians. I only know two gentlemen who sing at all well."
"I suppose it is the fashion to sing comic songs in a rhythmic way, leaving you to fancy the tune, very much as if it were tapped on a drum."
"Ah, you have heard Mr. Bowyer," said Rosamond, with one of her rare smiles. "But we are speaking very ill of our neighbours."
Lydgate was almost forgetting that he must carry on the conversation, in thinking how lovely this creature was, her garment seeming to be made out of the faintest blue sky, herself so immaculately blonde, as if the petals of some gigantic flower had just opened and disclosed her, and yet, with this infantile blondness, showing so much ready, self-possessed grace. Since he had had the memory of Laure, Lydgate had lost all taste for large-eyed silence. The divine cow no longer attracted him, and Rosamond was her very opposite. But he recalled himself. "You will let me hear some music tonight, I hope."
"I will let you hear my attempts, if you like," said Rosamond. "Papa is sure to insist on my singing. But I shall tremble before you, who have heard the best singers in Paris. I have heard very little. I have only once been to London. But our organist at St. Peter's is a good musician, and I go on studying with him."
"Tell me what you saw in London."
"Very little."
A more naive girl would have said, "Oh, everything," but Rosamond knew better.
"A few of the ordinary sights, such as raw country girls are always taken to."
"Do you call yourself a raw country girl?" said Lydgate, looking at her with an involuntary emphasis of admiration, which made Rosamond blush with pleasure. But she remained simply serious, turned her long neck a little, and put up her hand to touch her wondrous hair plaits, an habitual gesture with her, as pretty as any movements of a kitten's paw. Not that Rosamond was in the least like a kitten. She was a sylph caught young, and educated at Mrs. Lemon's.
"I assure you my mind is raw," she said immediately. "I pass at Middlemarch. I am not afraid of talking to our old neighbours, but I am really afraid of you."
"An accomplished woman almost always knows more than we men, though her knowledge is of a different sort. I am sure you could teach me a thousand things, as an exquisite bird could teach a bear, if there were any common language between them. Happily, there is a common language between women and men, and so the bears can get taught."
"Ah, there is Fred beginning to strum. I must go and hinder him from jarring all your nerves," said Rosamond, moving to the other side of the room, where Fred, having opened the piano at his father's desire that Rosamond might give them some music, was parenthetically performing Cherry Ripe with one hand. Able men, who have passed their examinations, will do these things sometimes not less than the plucked Fred.
"Fred, pray defer your practising till tomorrow. You will make Mr. Lydgate ill," said Rosamond. "He has an ear."
Fred laughed and went on with his tune to the end. Rosamond turned to Lydgate, smiling gently, and said,
"You perceive, the bears will not always be taught."
"Now then, Rosie," said Fred, springing from the stool and twisting it upward for her with a hearty expectation of enjoyment. "Some good rousing tunes first."
Rosamond played admirably. Her master at Mrs. Lemon's school, close to a county town with a memorable history that had its relics in church and castle, was one of those excellent musicians here and there to be found in our provinces, worthy to compare with many a noted Kapellmeister in a country which offers more plentiful conditions of musical celebrity. Rosamond, with the executant's instinct, had seized his manner of playing and gave forth his large rendering of noble music with the precision of an echo. It was almost startling, heard for the first time. A hidden soul seemed to be flowing forth from Rosamond's fingers. And so indeed it was, since souls live on in perpetual echoes, and to all fine expression there goes somewhere an originating activity, if it be only that of an interpreter. Lydgate was taken possession of, and began to believe in her as something exceptional. After all, he thought, one need not be surprised to find the rare conjunctions of nature under circumstances apparently unfavourable. Come where they may, they always depend on conditions that are not obvious. He sat looking at her, and did not rise to pay her any compliments, leaving that to others, now that his admiration was deepened. Her singing was less remarkable, but also well-trained, and sweet to hear as a chime perfectly in tune. It is true she sang "Meet Me by the Moonlight" and "I've Been Roaming," for mortals must share the fashions of their time, and none but the ancients can be always classical. But Rosamond could also sing "Black-Eyed Susan" with effect, or Haydn's canzonettes, or "Voi che sapete," or "Batti, batti." She only wanted to know what her audience liked. Her father looked round at the company, delighting in their admiration. Her mother sat like a Niobe before her troubles, with her youngest little girl on her lap, softly beating the child's hand up and down in time to the music. And Fred, notwithstanding his general scepticism about Rosie, listened to her music with perfect allegiance, wishing he could do the same thing on his flute. It was the pleasantest family party that Lydgate had seen since he came to Middlemarch.
The Vincys had the readiness to enjoy, the rejection of all anxiety, and the belief in life as a merry lot, which made a house exceptional in most county towns at that time, when evangelicalism had cast a certain suspicion as of plague infection over the few amusements which survived in the provinces. At the Vincys there was always whist, and the card tables stood ready now, making some of the company secretly impatient of the music. Before it ceased, Mr. Fairbrother came in, a handsome, broad-chested, but otherwise small man, about 40, whose black was very threadbare. The brilliancy was all in his quick grey eyes. He came like a pleasant change in the light, arresting little Louisa with fatherly nonsense as she was being led out of the room by Miss Morgan, greeting everybody with some special word, and seeming to condense more talk into 10 minutes than had been held all through the evening. He claimed from Lydgate the fulfilment of a promise to come and see him. "I can't let you off, you know, because I have some beetles to show you. We collectors feel an interest in every new man till he has seen all we have to show him." But soon he swerved to the whist table, rubbing his hands and saying, "Come now, let us be serious." "Mr. Lydgate?" "Not play?" "Ah, you are too young and light for this kind of thing." Lydgate said to himself that the clergyman whose abilities were so painful to Mr. Bulstrode appeared to have found an agreeable resort in this certainly not erudite household. He could half understand it. The good humour, the good looks of elder and younger, and the provision for passing the time without any labour of intelligence might make the house beguiling to people who had no particular use for their odd hours. Everything looked blooming and joyous, except Miss Morgan, who was brown, dull, and resigned, and altogether, as Mrs. Vincey often said, just the sort of person for a governess.
Lydgate did not mean to pay many such visits himself. They were a wretched waste of the evenings, and now, when he had talked a little more to Rosamond, he meant to excuse himself and go. "You will not like us at Middlemarch, I feel sure," she said, when the whist players were settled. "We are very stupid, and you have been used to something quite different."
"I suppose all country towns are pretty much alike," said Lydgate.
"But I have noticed that one always believes one's own town to be more stupid than any other. I have made up my mind to take Middlemarch as it comes, and shall be much obliged if the town will take me in the same way. I have certainly found some charms in it, which are much greater than I had expected."
"You mean the rides towards Tipton and Lowick? Everyone is pleased with those," said Rosamond, with simplicity.
"No, I mean something much nearer to me." Rosamond rose and reached her netting, and then said,
"Do you care about dancing at all? I am not quite sure whether clever men ever dance."
"I would dance with you, if you would allow me."
"Oh," said Rosamond with a slight deprecatory laugh, "I was only going to say that we sometimes have dancing, and I wanted to know whether you would feel insulted if you were asked to come."
"Not on the condition I mentioned." After this chat, Lydgate thought that he was going, but on moving towards the whist tables, he got interested in watching Mr. Fairbrother's play, which was masterly, and also his face, which was a striking mixture of the shrewd and the mild. At 10 o'clock supper was brought in, such were the customs of Middlemarch, and there was punch drinking. But Mr. Fairbrother had only a glass of water. He was winning, but there seemed to be no reason why the renewal of rubbers should end, and Lydgate at last took his leave. But as it was not 11 o'clock, he chose to walk in the brisk air towards the tower of St. Botolph's, Mr. Fairbrother's church, which stood out dark, square and massive against the starlight. It was the oldest church in Middlemarch. The living, however, was but a vicarage worth barely 400 a year. Lydgate had heard that, and he wondered now whether Mr. Fairbrother cared about the money he won at cards, thinking, "He seems a very pleasant fellow, but Bulstrode may have his good reasons." Many things would be easier to Lydgate if it should turn out that Mr. Bulstrode was generally justifiable. What is his religious doctrine to me if he carries some good notions along with it? One must use such brains as are to be found. These were actually Lydgate's first meditations as he walked away from Mr. Vincey's, and on this ground I fear that many ladies will consider him hardly worthy of their attention. He thought of Rosamond and her music only in the second place, and though, when her turn came, he dwelt on the image of her for the rest of his walk, he felt no agitation, and had no sense that any new current had set into his life. He could not marry yet. He wished not to marry for several years, and therefore he was not ready to entertain the notion of being in love with a girl whom he happened to admire. He did admire Rosamond exceedingly, but that madness which had once beset him about Laure was not, he thought, likely to recur in relation to any other woman. Certainly, if falling in love had been at all in question, it would have been quite safe with a creature like this Miss Vincey, who had just the kind of intelligence one would desire in a woman, polished, refined, docile, lending itself to finish in all the delicacies of life, and enshrined in a body which expressed this with a force of demonstration that excluded the need for other evidence. Lydgate felt sure that if ever he married, his wife would have that feminine radiance, that distinctive womanhood, which must be classed with flowers and music, that sort of beauty which by its very nature was virtuous, being moulded only for pure and delicate joys. But since he did not mean to marry for the next 5 years, his more pressing business was to look into Louis's new book on fever, which he was specially interested in, because he had known Louis in Paris, and had followed many anatomical demonstrations, in order to ascertain the specific differences of typhus and typhoid. He went home and read far into the smallest hour, bringing a much more testing vision of details and relations into this pathological study than he had ever thought it necessary to apply to the complexities of love and marriage, these being subjects on which he felt himself amply informed by literature and that traditional wisdom which is handed down in the genial conversation of men. Whereas fever had obscure conditions and gave him that delightful labour of the imagination which is not mere arbitrariness, but the exercise of disciplined power, combining and constructing with the clearest eye for probabilities and the fullest obedience to knowledge, and then, in yet more energetic alliance with impartial nature, standing aloof to invent tests by which to try its own work.
End of disc 5.